Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. The first drawing I saw by Gabriel Lehman put a huge smile on my face. It was a cartoon-like drawing of a wide-eyed, fairy-like girl having a conversation with a friendly, multicolored elephant. When I learned that the 41-year-old artist has no formal training, I was stunned. Gabriel says as a kid, he always had a pencil in his hand, doodling and drawing, but he has conceptual dyslexia, so traditional learning was a struggle. And when he graduated from high school, he knew he had to use his hands to create a career. But at that time, he chose construction, spending a dozen years installing flooring in homes. The physical strain got to him, as did the internal calling that was coaxing him to give that love of drawing a second chance. He did. He quit his job and focused all of his time and effort on honing his skills. Because he had spent so much time in people's homes, he knew what kind of color palette appealed to people, so he included those colors in his paintings. He lived out of his car, spending what little money he had on paint and brushes. His focus paid off when he was invited to show his work at a solo show, where he met many famous artists who encouraged him to live his dream. From there, the sky was the limit, which also described his work. Gabriel loves to paint murals, and in those murals, clouds. Gratitude is also important to him. He donates paintings to charities and loves to paint murals in unusual places, like the nursery of a church in Noblesville. And that's where I met him and his wife, Jamie Lehman, who is an author. We sat and talked with the cheery blue sky and clouds as our background.
I'm Gabriel Lehman. I'm an artist.
I'm Jamie Lehman, and I'm an author.
When I started painting, I realized very early on that there are no rules when it comes to artwork, so I had to create some of my own rules. So I started creating this world. Like, there's no internal combustion engine, there's no electricity or anything like that. So creating these guidelines gave me a world that I could start creating that I could work within. And I do lean towards the high elevation because I just love painting clouds.
Essentially, what I do with words is what Gabriel does with his paintings. I like to keep things very, very playful, very innocent, and kind of explore, like, Gabriel's world doesn't have internal combustion engines and things like that. I don't use electronics or anything in my writing. It's all, you know, back to basics and kind of playing in the dirt kind of stuff. And all of my work rhymes, and I like to have some either a surprise at the end or something very sweet for the kids.
Jamie had a book in mind when she met Gabriel at an art show.
I was there with one of my friends, and there was a lot of beautiful art, but when I saw Gabriel's, it stopped me in my tracks. And I remember telling my friend, I was like, there's no way he's here, because the artists were speaking with people, and I saw him talking with a couple people, and I kind of worked up the nerve to go talk to him, and I told him I wanted to work with him, and he was very polite. But I looked him up later, and I kept sending him messages and some of my work and asking him if we could meet and possibly work together. And eventually he agreed, and our first business meeting turned into our first date.
Once she lured you in to do the illustrations for her book, how long did it take before it went from business to more than that?
Oh, it was an instant infatuation, I think. On both sides, we were very curious about each other and why do you work the way that you work. I didn't want to be in a relationship where you would have to argue over, I want to give this, or I want to donate this. I wanted it to be, we have to be on the same page. And Jamie is a very, very kind and giving heart.
Their first literary collaboration is a flip-style storybook for kids.
That came from two short little story poems. It's very sing-song, rhymey.
One side features the story Kitty Calamity, Flip It Over, for Splat.
And I had this cartoon character that I made up when I think I was 5 years old when I started drawing him. I was a huge Calvin and Hobbes and Jim Davis fan. So that's why I've got this really bubbly character that I'd been, you know, drawing since I was a little kid. And I was like, I want him to be Splat.
The kind of stories that I write about these little boys, Gabriel is that little boy, and he was that little boy as a child.
Yeah, my nickname in the family was called Spot, because I usually had a spot on my head that was shaved for stitches.
Their latest book benefits the dog therapy group Pause and Think. It features the courageous tale of their friend's dog, Pipsqueak.
They have a little 2-pound Yorkshire Terrier. She's very, very sweet, but she has a lot of health issues. So we wanted the book to focus on her strengths and you know, that she's tough and she's a warrior, and it's not going to keep her down. And it was this wonderful, like, 10 minutes of us coming up with the concept for it. And then it just happened immediately. We just sat down, he started drawing, and I started writing just at the same time.
I made the paper for this. It was a real treat. I won't ever do it again.
Gabriel enjoys illustrating Jamie's books, but large-scale painting remains his passion.
It's fun for me because you get to see more of it. I think you can get involved with it, and especially doing public works and stuff like that. Someone's driving down the road and sees a big wall that has, you know, some magical clouds happening and some beautiful things, and it might just brighten their day.
His murals have brightened the days of people in a number of places.
The Witham Hospital, the radiation chamber in there, was pretty special for me, even though it's just clouds. But what it means, you know, when you're in there getting radiation, you look up at this huge sky, and they put mirrors all the way around it, so it's an endless sky. The clouds continue, and it's a very special thing for me, you know, to know that people get to look at that while they're dealing with something.
And there's a mural at Wellspring Transitional Housing in Martinsville, and that's a really large mural, and that was really special for Gabriel because he got to speak with the residents and kind of bring in elements that they had missed from their own homes that they might have lost, especially pets. That was a really big thing for them because it doesn't allow pets.
Well, they were transitioning from, was it Katrina? That they were transitioning from, coming back home. They were in the common area where I did this huge wall. I had about 35, 40 feet of it, so I got to really go nutso on it. And they kept mentioning, oh, they were talking about their animals and stuff. I was like, I'll paint you a dog in there. I'll paint you a cat in there. Yeah, we'll bring a little home into your new situation.
There's a gorgeous mural of a girl with a cloud machine making clouds.
That mural is on the Horizon Bank building in downtown Noblesville. It was just a few blocks from the church, so we went to see it in person.
What is it about clouds?
I don't know. You know, it's funny, when my first couple of years of painting, didn't paint a cloud. I was not into them. I was just a huge, huge fan of clouds, and I was always scared to paint them. So I started, you know, working them in, and I found that I look at them all the time, so I'm constantly studying them all the time. When I go in and start working, you know, my mood comes out in the clouds and the sky and different things like that. I don't know, they're just incredibly expressive, and I've gotten a lot better at it.
Yeah, they're very realistic. Do you remember the process? What all you had to do when you created this?
Oh, it was we had to scrub the wall really good. Build the scaffolding, and then you know, figure out what I used, a stucco paint, so mixing my colors ahead of time and then matching the colors, and that wall's pretty rough, and I had a lot of ideas that I had to kind of bail on because it required a lot of detail, and that you know, you can only do so much when you're working directly on top of, you know, 100-year-old brick.
Are you happy with it?
Oh, I love it. It's really fun, and people just love it, you know. One lady was like, I almost got in a wreck in my car because of you. I was staring at that painting and almost ran into the truck in front of me. I'm like, I'll take it. Yeah, I'll take that.
Both Gabriel and Jamie first discovered their love for art and writing when they were in kindergarten. And because of that, they will be visiting numerous kindergarten classes in central Indiana, reading from Pipsqueak and Splat. We'll be right back. Each week, we bring you Making It, audio postcards from Indiana DIY artists who are making it on their own. This week, WFYI's Melissa Davis speaks with an artist who specializes in screen printing. Melissa met her at her home studio on the north side of Indianapolis.
Hi, I'm Steph Renner, a.k.a. Mythmaker, and I'm making screen-printed goods.
And why is screen printing your preferred medium?
It's so versatile. I've always loved making patterns and the beauty of each printed good. Each one's just slightly different. You can just do so much with it. And I'm trying to teach myself all the different ways I can expand being a maker and a screen printer.
If you don't tape it off, then that will get on the shirt. So I'm gonna tape it real quick. A lot of my designs are about plants and women and cycles and all that kind of stuff. So
when you started making art and drawing as a kid, did that have anything to do with your art even back then?
It did in a way that it pushed me to this, because I grew up very conservative Christian, and I became an atheist in high school. And then I realized how spiritually inclined that I am, and that it was silly for me to just write off religion. And so I started delving into the origins of civilizations, especially ancient Egypt, and just different understandings and archetypes, and how religion was used as a tool by different communities to glean these spiritual insights. And I realized that I don't need to have a problem with Christianity. I can use that as a tool as well. So now I try to find the archetypes or universal truths in all different kinds of practices and put them to use in my own life. So it's been a process, but when I was younger, I was kind of in a different mindset, and I was shy and wasn't capable of speaking my truth. I was afraid of all the judgment, and it took a long time to kind of break from that and not feel shameful about leaving the religion that my whole family practices. But it was worth it, and I've been getting closer with people and feeling like I'm healing. We're in my basement. I have a four-color manual screen printing press. So basically, you can load four screens at once and print on one surface, so you can do four colors. It has this rotary, like really heavy metal, where the screens lock in, and that's what rotates. And it's sitting on top of a dryer unit with a conveyor belt. So you print the shirts, and then you run them through the dryer to cure the ink. And that's, you know, just the last step of the process. I went to school for printmaking, but I took one screen printing class, and the teacher wouldn't let us experiment with what we were doing. And so I turned in my project, and he said he didn't know how to grade it and said he was going to have to fail me. He ended up giving me a C so that I could pass. But all I was doing was experimenting with different layers of ink, and I loved it. And then I went back for another semester, and he added two pages to the syllabus, like outlawing everything that I had done. So I dropped the class. Basically, after you print the shirt, the ink is wet, and I use water-based ink, and so it needs to cure at 350, 360 degrees. And so this conveyor belt just pushes the shirt right on through. You just kind of set the shirt at the end, and it'll move it along and cure the ink in the process.
Is this your full-time job?
It's not. I wish. I mean, I treat it like a full-time job. I'm always printing when I get home from work, but I'm kind of an accident-prone person, and I really need health insurance for various reasons, and I can't afford it yet on my own. So I work 4 days a week at my parents' financial advising company. It's a busy life.
And then you're also a drummer.
Yeah, I've also been drumming about 10 years now. I play with my band Hex Mundi. We've been a band for, I think, 3-4 years. I can't believe it's been that long already.
It seems.
I love listening to music while I work. It's great. I have headphones that I'm always wearing down here. I have different playlists. I have a drum playlist, songs that I like with interesting beats, and I'll listen to it a lot while I'm working and then go practice afterwards. Yeah, it's great.
How does place factor into your art?
Place? Like where I live and everything? Well, Indianapolis is kind of booming with artistic and musical creative talent at the moment. I don't know, maybe I was just too young and didn't know how to branch out or something, but I wanted to leave really badly, not live here. And I ended up moving back here after spending a little bit of time living in Bloomington, just living there, not going to school there. And I moved back and was just so pleasantly surprised that so many artists and musicians are creating a huge community that keeps growing and one that supports each other. I don't get the vibe that it's, you know, a cutthroat type of competitive environment. I kind of see it as everyone's excited that everyone is creating and, you know, kind of just supporting each other. So I'm really thankful for all of that.
Just ahead on Curious Mix, keep it simple.
Just be yourself and sing the song.
And enjoy the ride.
There's a lot of stuff that's interesting going on, and it's all going on at once.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Why would a group of teenagers from across the country spend a week in Carmel, Indiana, studying and performing music that was popular decades before they were born? Curious Mix contributor Carter Barrett takes us to the Songbook Academy.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face that music and dance.
Hello, I'm Reed Knepper. I am from Cincinnati, Ohio.
17-year-old Knepper is on stage at the Carmel Performing Arts Center singing Let's Face the Music and Dance, which was written in 1936.
We'll be without the moon, hum in a different tune, and then...
He is one of 40 high school students and recent graduates participating in the Songbook Academy, a week-long music intensive focused on classic jazz, Broadway, and Hollywood songs. Performs, Knepper will be critiqued by Michael Feinstein, the founder of the Songbook Academy and a 5-time Grammy Award nominee.
This song was written in a very specific time, and it's a song about the Depression.
I was not depressed.
Well, if you look at the lyric is saying there may be trouble ahead. That was an allusion to what was happening in the world. It was one of the worst times of the American Depression. So, there has to be a sense of desperation in the song underneath the finger snapping stuff. So it's really important to look at the text of what you're singing.
The participants spend a full week honing their craft with instruction from Broadway actors and Hollywood professionals. Chris Lewis, the executive director of the Great American Songbook Foundation, says the American Songbook is an informal collection of songs that have lasted beyond their years.
Our purpose as a nonprofit is to focus on the composers and performers of what's considered the golden age, really the 20s through about the 60s. So Cole Porter, Hoagy Carmichael, Rodgers and Hart, and Hammerstein.
What do you think would be lost for the musical theater or the music community without a program like this?
There are musical theater camps. There's acting camps. There are jazz camps. I don't think there's anywhere, any program that's specifically focused on the Great American Songbook. And so, like I said before, school programs, arts programs are being cut. Teachers don't have the time in the classroom to teach, you know, who Richard Rodgers was or Cole Porter. And if we don't, this bit of history will be gone. This important part of American cultural history will be lost.
For the participants, this is also an opportunity to connect with people who love the songbook as much as they do.
When I found out that I was coming, I was shocked. I was so excited to sing with 40 of the best singers in the country.
Let's face the music and dance.
When people are singing a song, I feel like that I have to act it out, or I have to put on someone else, like be someone else, be a different character. But what I've learned here, and this is like mind-blowing to me, is just be yourself. You're telling a story to the audience. You know, what do you want the audience to learn from you? Like, why are you saying these words? And just be yourself and sing the song. It seems so simple, and it seems like you should be doing so much more.
But while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's...
For Curious Mix, I'm Carter Barrett.
If you ever want to get a sense of the cool vibe of a city, talk to an artist. Curious Mix contributor Bob Williams introduces us to a local Renaissance man who has his fingers on multiple indie arts pulses.
Meet Mike Graves. No, not the nationally known Indianapolis native who designs stuff for department stores and such. That's Michael Graves. This is Indianapolis Mike Graves, the rapper.
The superhuman, super Hoosier, superhero. When me and Harvey get together, we're like Pesci and De Niro. We start a new track at 000. Then I use my superpowers and I press rewind.
And this is Mike Graves, the artist. Shh, he's painting. And this is Mike Graves. He's DJing. And this is Mike Graves. If you can't tell, he's chefing my lunch, chicken tacos from the kids' menu, at Shoe Fly. And this is Mike Graves. Shh. Now he's sculpting. He's also a poet, has an apparel line, and is an art space curator. Mike does a lot from his space at the Murphy Building in Fountain Square, an appropriate headquarters for him because it's a cool place to be, and Mike is usually the coolest dude in the room, regardless of the room. With his straight-billed ball cap, dreads, silver nose ring, and a smile so bright lamps aren't needed in that room, Mike proclaims all is good and getting better every day on the Indianapolis art scene. More on his pronouncement in a moment, but first, a check of his bona fides. Born in Indy, raised in an Air Force family, Heron School of Art, noted graffiti artist, he's arrived, and he's thrived.
I'm lucky in the fact that I've known since I was probably 6 years old what I was going to do. I won an art contest in elementary school drawing a Super Smurf on panel board, and I got the blue ribbon, and ever since then, I was like, yeah, that's me. That's what I do. I'm an artist. Yeah.
Early, you were mostly graffiti, right? Would you describe that as a solo endeavor or a collaborative endeavor?
Oh, that was definitely a collaborative endeavor. My solo endeavors at that time were I was trying to transfer from the graffiti and the comic book stuff that I grew up doing into the stuff that I was learning in art school. Mm-hmm. So all my graffiti stuff was with my friends late night in the streets. You know, like I wasn't doing graffiti on canvas for the longest time. I was only doing graffiti on trains and walls with my friends, late night, all illegal stuff. Years later, when I got on this side of the fence of doing galleries, I was still friends with these guys, and I just pulled them up with me. I was like, man, I'm doing galleries and doing canvases, and we should do collabos and bring some of this style to the other side of the gallery world, and they were all for it.
What's your favorite style of the stuff that you do?
You know, actually, sculpture is my first love. I love sculpture the most. I get to do it the least, but that is where I'm most happy, is doing metal sculpture,
And then there's the collaborative with Elvis Myers, an old friend of his.
We got commissioned by the people who built the Forte, Von Dalen Enterprises. They'd seen his stuff and seen my stuff. And we're like, would you guys mind doing a collaboration? And of course we were like, you're going to pay us to do what we already wanted to do. So we got together.
It's a big piece.
Oh, it's huge. It's two panels, actually, and both of them are 6 feet tall. One's 5 feet wide. One's 4 feet wide. And they hang next to each other in the Forte. And it's a portrait of Wes Montgomery with all original Wes Montgomery vinyl on the other side. And as far as I know, it's the only solo portrait tribute to Wes Montgomery in the city.
What is the state of the art from the ground up?
From where I'm sitting? There's a lot of stuff that's interesting going on, and it's all going on at once. If you're into music, there's good music to be seen. If you're into art, there's some good art to be seen. If you're into food, there's some good food to be had in this city. Like, it's all going pretty decent right now.
And you're involved in all of it.
Come see me.
Wow, there's a lot to do. Got to get busy. For Curious Mix, this is Bob Williams.
Sound Expeditions is an audio soundtrack curated by Indianapolis arts enthusiast Michael Kaufman. He gathered a number of musicians and asked each to use original music and natural sound to create a story about a specific site in the city. Curious Mix contributor Kyle Long shares a piece called Carbon and Oxygen. It was composed by musician Jordan Munson for the opening of the 100 Acres Nature Park at Newfields.
I'm Jordan Munson, and my piece for Sound Expeditions is Carbon and Oxygen. So I composed this piece for the opening of IMA 100 Acres, specifically the Visitors Pavilion. It's kind of hidden in the forest there at the IMA. And I was trying to create work that responded to the material of the building, things that were a bit architectural as well, because it's a really striking building, a striking facade to the building, and using a lot of sounds that were wood and wind and things that were connected to the texture and the materials of the environment around me. And the work, this is an excerpt from the work, but the work, original work, was a few hours long, and it came out of this live improvisation that happened for the opening of the park. Sort of wooden flute sounds, things that were, there's, you know, some metal in the structure, so some kalimba, imbira type sounds, and a lot of pure tones too. There was a kind of a simplicity and a pureness to that visitor's pavilion, so kind of generative sine waves kind of guiding me through the performance. So it was a lot of reaction to what was happening there. I've done site-specific works before and since, special event-type performances and creating work for one specific event is something that I'm interested in and I do often. And I think, at least for me, the way I go about it is to try to let the idea of the space marinate with me and not try to explicitly connect an element of that space or something directly to the sounds I'm making. I want to have a little more nuance than that, so it's a little bit more about the feeling of the space and how I react to it, what I think is complementary, as opposed to just, there's wooden planks here, so I'm going to hit a bunch of wooden planks, you know. Doing any kind of live performance, or especially where I'm creating new work and pushing myself to create new things for the live performance, because then little elements of that stay with you and lets you, I think, get to newer ideas. Not creating in a vacuum, but you know, working, responding to things in the environment or other people, and so yeah, there's certainly a thread of aesthetic that stays with me.
It's time to perk up our palates with a little help from Yelp, the online community of ordinary eaters who find the tastiest places in town when it comes to ethnic eats. For satisfying food and soothing music, try the Pad Thai at Bangkok Restaurant and Jazz Bar in downtown Indianapolis.
Hi, my name is Tom Promku, and I'm the chef manager at the Bangkok Restaurant and Jazz Bar in downtown Indianapolis. The ingredients for the Pad Thai is really simple. We use the rice noodle, which is made from rice from Thailand. We cook with the Pad Thai sauce, which is made from tamarind, bean sprout, green onions, and ground peanut, and the egg. And the customer have the choice of the proteins. They can choose, you know, from chicken, beef, pork, shrimp, or even tofu or vegetables. We're gonna use the wok to cook with the high heat. Then we put the oil, the cooking oil, into the wok. And after that, the first thing we put is the egg. Then we put the noodle, the Pad Thai noodle, into the wok and cook together with the egg. This process is gonna take about maybe close to three minutes until the noodle get very soft and cooked. After that, I'm going to put the Pad Thai sauce into the noodles and the egg, and we stir fry together. We're going to put the protein into the noodle while we cook the noodle. And after that, bean sprout and a green onion and ground peanut. And that's it. Pad Thai noodle, it has a lot of flavor in it. It tastes a little sweet and a little sour from the tamarind. It looks very good.
Bangkok Restaurant and Jazz Bar is located at 225 East Ohio Street. Still to come on Curious Mix, Step Lightly.
If you go inside, you may not come out the same person who went in.
And breathe deeply.
Yeasty, kind of clovey and spicy and coriander kind of flavors to it.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. Indianapolis pastor Tony Bunch has multiple degrees in business, human services, logistics, and early childcare development. She uses that knowledge daily as senior pastor of Lilies of the Valley Christian Church. Her outreach programs benefit her congregation and nearby community year-round, and in the summer, her ministry nourishes more than the soul. Curious Mix contributor Katie Simpson spent some time with the Lunch Bunch.
Yeah, I love freedom. I'm a grown person.
Pastor Tony Bunch has been feeding children for almost 20 years. She remembers one time she saw children digging in the dumpster for food.
And I say, stay right here.
Bunch says she went to McDonald's and got the children some Happy Meals. Now she partners with the Children's Museum to serve 200 lunches each weekday at Coppin Chapel AME and from two other churches. She says this year she's seen more latchkey kids than ever.
The name latchkey came from because there's a latch on the other side of the door. When the parents would leave, they would say, lock the door and put the latch on so nobody can come in and get their children.
Bunch says, for those not allowed to leave their houses, she sets a plate outside the door and rings the bell. She began serving meals when she owned a daycare. A few neighborhood children began coming by and asking for food in the summer. She hesitated at first, but then started letting them come in and eat.
Halfway through the summer, they start bringing their friends. It's like, I can't feed all these kids. God said, feed them. And I said, okay, there's got to be a better way. Because you're not supposed to feed kids, that's not in your program. But what was I going to do? Tell those kids they couldn't eat? Mm. And they said, we want some of the food they got.
She fed 25 extra children that summer. The next year, the Children's Museum called and offered to provide her with meals.
And I said, that would never happen again. I would never go across a child hungry and not feed them.
She says she's committed to serving those she calls the lost, least, and last. Word spread about Bunch's program. A local daycare walks students to eat there every weekday. Kelly Sissel brings children from Loving Hearts International Academy. She raves about the program and about Pastor Bunch.
These are great meals and great friendships. And she's a pastor and she has her own church. And if you need prayer or anything, it's right here. It's right here. What's my superpower name?
I was trying to encourage families coming back together. As you've seen, the mother with her three children with the crazy color hair. I'm teaching her, sit down at the table and eat with your children. Don't just sit them and let them take food all over the house. No, it's family time. So now when she comes, she takes time and she feeds the baby and she's talking to her kids.
Bunch brings anyone she can into the program and finds a way for them to get involved. She asks older members of her church to help with meal prep and serving the children. She even asks older kids to help.
And those girls, you see them serving, they'll never forget that. My daughters do it all the time. Those other two did. And so they feel so proud. Take our pictures for our mommy. Show that we're serving people. They're learning at this age how to serve others.
And what's your favorite part of coming here?
Eating. For Curious Mix, I'm Katie Simpson.
How does a poem inspire a visual artist like this? Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
I'm a big fan of bookstores and libraries. In anxious days, even days where I have nothing to do, I love to go to the library and peruse the collection, and I'm always coming out with something, which reminded me of this poem by Alberto Rios, and it's called Don't Go Into the Library. The library is dangerous. Don't go in. If you do, you know what will happen. It's like a pet store or a bakery. Every single time you come out of there, holding something in your arms. Those novels with their big eyes and their no-nonsense, all-muscle, greyhounds and Dobermans, all nonfiction and business. Cuddly when they're young, but then the first page is turned. The donut scent of it all, knowledge, the aroma of coffee being made, in all those books, something for everyone. The deli offerings of civilization itself. The library is the book of books. It's concrete and wood and glass covers, keeping within them the very big, very long story of everything. The library is dangerous, full of answers. If you go inside, you may not come out the same person who went in.
You hope not, I would think.
Yes, that's true. I would hope you're a little bit of a better person. And it's free, which, how awesome is that?
That's Terry Border. He'll be back again next week with another poem that's long overdue for hearing. Seems like you can't walk down the street these days without discovering a new brewery popping up in your neighborhood. For the matriarch of Indiana beer, it's a thirst-quenching reflection of brewer's commitment to community and a delicious reminder of her European roots. Curious Mix contributor Michael Atwood catches up with an old friend.
Rita!
Hello, Mike.
You?
This is great to see you again.
Full disclosure, Rita Kahn and I go way back. We collaborated on a documentary 15 years ago.
What brings you out to the Indiana State Fair on this lovely day?
You do.
Well, I didn't know I was an attraction.
Well, she may not guess your weight or predict your future, but Rita Kahn is most certainly an attraction. Sagamore of the Wabash, author, playwright, journalist, activist, wise sage of the arts scene. Truly a living Indianapolis legend. Still going strong even after hip replacement surgery at 80 years of age. Among her many interests, Rita has a deep, abiding, and philosophical passion for beer. And not just any suds.
It's my European tradition. And one had beer with one's meal. And one had a quality of life built around good food, good beverage, never really overdoing on either.
She's written extensively on the local beer scene, including a regular column in Nuvo, Beer Buzz, and the book True Brew, A Guide to Craft Beer in Indiana.
The whole thing about beer is that it's this beautiful collaboration between brewers and their delight and passion to share it with you and me.
Are we going to go in and take a look?
We can go in and take a look.
I caught up with Rita at the Indiana Farmers Coliseum for the 20th annual Indiana Brewers Cup, the Indiana State Fair's craft beer competition, and the Hoosier State's top contest for hoppy people, both professional and home brewers.
The first Indiana Brewers Cup had 127 entries.
Haley Lamp is events manager for the Indiana State Fair.
And so now we're looking at 1,500 entries. It's just exploded. It has exploded.
It's true. Local craft brewing has exploded over the past 20 years. And Rita has been there since the first bottle top was popped. She's served as a steward for the Brewers' Cup for 19 of those 20 years. Beer stewards bring out the brews, make sure judges have water and soda crackers to cleanse their palates. They also keep track of scores and ensure that judges don't know who brewed the beer they're tasting.
Hello, Latrice. It's Rita. I was checking because Andy just said you hadn't checked in yet.
There's been a slight mix-up. One of the stewards has not shown up for their shift. But Rita has a solution, and I find myself drafted, if you will, into being a steward.
Again, because we're so short-handed and we've got a lot to go through.
A quick training session follows, then I, along with Rita, soon find ourselves helping a table of judges with a variety of homebrew beers.
Our categories here are Belgian style wit beers, which have a very specific kind of player profile that involves yeasty, kind of clovey and spicy and coriander kind of flavors to it. My name is Kevin Smolar, S-M-O-L-A-R. I'm actually the quality control manager at Sun King Brewery. I've been judging beer, though, for a few years. I'm a certified BJCP judge, and I've just been a big fan of beer, and especially in college, and then decided to take a class on beer in college, and, you know, 9 years later, here I am.
It's not exactly what I imagined. I guess I thought there would be music playing with festivities and hearty cheers as frothy libations were lifted in celebration of the brewer's art. But it was quiet, really quiet.
They're really concentrating, so they're really, you know, it's quiet. It's just penetrating silence.
I've never seen or heard a room full of beer drinkers be so darn quiet. That's because the judges take their sipping seriously, swirling their brews, sniffing, tasting, then making notes, lots of notes, all while referring to strict beer guidelines written by the BJCP Style Committee. BJCP is the Beer Judge Certification Program. Today, most of the certified judges here refer to their smartphones for information on more than 20 styles of beer.
I don't think it's a bad beer by any means.
I thought it was lacking coriander. Yeah. I thought
my favorite style is a Belgian. But when someone says, "What's your favorite beer?" I always honestly say the one that's in my hand.
For Rita, beer is more than its four simple ingredients of barley, hops, yeast, and water. Beer is culture and community, science and art, history and tradition. In 2017, a new chapter in beer history was tapped when local brewers at Scarlet Lane Brewing and the Broad Ripple Brew Pub collaborated with Nouveau to honor the matriarch of Indiana beer. The result? An original oatmeal pale ale with passion fruit and lemon called Hangin' Tough, with a grandmotherly cartoon likeness of Rita, hangin' tough on each bottle.
One gathered around food and one gathered around a good beverage, and one had conversation, civil conversation. That's hard to come by anymore. And we didn't tweet and Twitter.
For Curious Mix, I'm Michael Atwood.
Special thanks to the beer aficionados and the band Polka Boy for providing a bit of oompa to that story. We've given you plenty to hear this hour, but this next story will require your eyes as well as your ears.
This weekend, check out a hot, young star cluster. I'm Matt Pelser, and this is your Weekend Sky Report. The brightest star in the constellation Perseus is Murfak, and it's where you need to look to find this weekend's target. The Alpha Persei cluster is an open cluster of hot, bluish-white B-type stars. These kinds of stars are so energetic, they don't live long. So most of the B-type stars we can see in the night sky are, on the cosmic scale, practically newborns. In fact, by the time most of the stars of the Alpha Persei cluster first formed, including the bright Murfak, the dinosaurs were already extinct. Under dark skies, you can see the cluster with the naked eye, but if you're near the city or if the moon is out, you'll need some help. A small telescope or even a pair of binoculars should provide enough magnification to notice a loose cluster of bright blue stars around Murfak. That's the Alpha Persei star cluster. The prominence of the constellation Perseus in the evening sky is a sure sign of autumn. It means you'll be able to observe the night sky without the help of bug spray very soon. I'm Matt Pelser. Happy sky watching.
Brandon Meeks composed and performs our music. And this curious mix was created by
Bob Williams,
Terry Border,
Melissa Davis,
Roxana Caldwell,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Kyle Long,
Matt Pelser,
Michael Atwood,
Katie Simpson,
Carter Barrett,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.